When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Now, we'll get started with the show, and I'll edit it from this point forward, and I'll tell you when we're off air. How about that? I'm going to punch you.
I cannot. Hey, y'all, if you're listening and he says he's just now pushed the recording button, he's an ass.
I'm not an ass.
Reggie, he's an ass. He should have pushed the recording button a long time ago because Briscoe and I had the greatest story, and it was one of those moments that were so real. Zip it. No one wants to hear from you. So
okay,
it's like,
here we go. I'm going to give you a good introduction. I'm going to lie about it.
I don't need no introduction. Sit down, strap in, and crank it up because you are listening to the Briscoe and Medusa show.
There you go. Thank you.
Would you shut up so I can start the show?
Oh, you haven't started. Let me guess. Did you push record?
We are recording right now.
Oh, good. Don't edit.
The show hasn't officially started.
Well, it has now.
The host.
Start.
Yes.
Medusa, you're right. Deborah, you're right. What Lakefield, I mean, you know, working with a Texan is just so difficult. Because they think they know everything. We have missed so many, award-winning moments because Lakefield can't figure out what that O-N stands for or that O-F-F stands for. We hadn't seen each other because we see each other all the time, used to, and we'll get into that later on. I used to think you were stalking me to tell you. But who wouldn't? But anyway, he never pushes the button. We had Stan Hansen on. We had Michael Hayes and Michael with Carson and all. You know how Michael is.
I got a good Michael Hayes story, too.
Oh, we're going to get into that, believe me. John, it's your turn.
Start the show, but we have been recording, and I'm going to put all that on air just to show you how you mistreat me.
Good. You know what? Because everyone's going to back my ass up. You damn straight.
No, they're on our side.
They don't like you.
Nobody does.
Welcome to Stories with Briscoe and Bradshaw. That's Briscoe. I'm Bradshaw. And in the world of professional wrestling, certain people have legacies defined. They define generations. There are cornerstones of generations. On the men's side, it's Frank Gotch, it's Lou Thesz, Bruno Sammartino, Hulk Hogan, Stone Cold Steve Austin, John Cena, and many others. And on the women's side, it's Mildred Burke, it's Wendy Richter, it's the Fabulous Moolah, Sherry Martel, and our guest, Medusa Alundra Blaze, who not only was the first non-Japanese woman to sign a contract to go to Japan and work for Giant Baba with All Japan, 40,000 people in the Egg Dome watching her fight over that championship. She also was the spark for the Monday Night Wars and a roundabout reason for the Montreal Screwjob. And despite all this, after a wrestling Hall of Fame career, she then had a Hall of Fame monster truck career. Two-time world champion, defeated her mentor, the legendary Dennis Anderson, 2005, first woman world champion. She is Medusa Alundra Blaze, and she has a huge crush on me. Welcome to the show.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you for that intro. Thank you. I just need to ask something. Is the record button on?
Yes, the record button's on.
Okay, just checking. Well, it's an honor to be here, even though you give kind of, screwed up instructions on how to get on to Zoom, and then you have to resend everything. But it's okay. You're a Texan.
Thank you. Now you know what I put up with all these times. People ask, how is it working with Layfield? Well, I got to give that Texan a dude. He's probably one of the most brilliant guys out there that's ever graced the squared circle. But when it comes to things like this, when it comes to common sense, Medusa, this guy, he left him in a change bucket at Stuckey's down on I-35 South.
Oh my, well, first of all, I want to tell you though, I'm just even looking back at your career, John, it's just been, you're good. Your psychology is amazing. I wish I would have got to work with you. It would have been great. I just,
you could have been with me instead of Rick Rude.
Well, I don't know.
Rude was pretty good. Rude was good.
I got some great Rick Rude stories too. And Paul Heyman stories. So, but we will not get to any of them. So maybe not. But yeah, I mean, I loved your career. I just thought you were great. I don't even know if we really did cross paths in Japan. I was hoping, but we didn't. And I just, gosh, as one person I wish I would have worked with, Briscoe. Absolutely.
Well, tell me about, like, I interviewed you for Legends with JBL on the WWE Network, and you told me about your starting up in Minnesota, because I started up in Minnesota, too, with Brad Rheingans and the mm-hmm. gym, which was an absolute – was that not the biggest chemical factory in the world, the gym? Remember that huge gym?
And Brad Rheingans? Yes.
No, not Brad. They had Brad Rheingans, but then you had the gym. It was just the gym.
Yes.
The gym. And you had like 40 guys who bench pressed 500 pounds back in the early 90s. It was insane.
It was a great gym. And were you, gosh, I can't believe, did we ever really cross paths then? Because you were already gone.
You were in Japan when I was up there with Brad.
What year, Medusa, was you up there with the Brad and Eddie?
I'm going to say 88. No, because I was in Japan in 88, 89, and 90. So it had to be like 86, 87.
Wow. You hear of all these horror stories, you know, the guys, the abuse that the guys took, you know, from the Sheik and all these guys that was training. Eddie's such a sweetheart of a man. It's hard for me to imagine Eddie been on you, but Brad Rheingans. Brad is one of the baddest SOBs that walked the face of the earth. Did you get any of that Greco training? Did you get any of that international training? I mean, were they as rough on you ladies as they supposedly were on the guys?
I wish I would have had more time with Brad, but I did. I got some great training with Brad at his place, and just I'm getting some flashbacks with, you know, it was like a big building at his house or something, maybe. I can't remember where it was.
When I was there, he had the ring in his basement. I don't know if
it in the basement. Oh, I don't know. This was a building. It's like a steel building or something. But anyway, I got to train with him, and I wish we would have had more time. And yes, they were rough. I remember when I first walked into the place that, you know, I was being introduced to this from Ed Sharkey and whatnot. And he's like, okay, 200 squats. I was like, what? Are you shitting me? I did, you know, the old, when you had a test and you're sitting there and they made you do 150 squats at a time. And I'm like, oh my God, boom. And then they throw your ass in the ring and just stretch your ass. And I overcame all of that and I came out well. So
now, yeah, you were a nurse at this time when you get in, what were you working in a gym and somebody sees you and said, hey, you know, you would be good at professional wrestling or
I was putting myself through nursing in Minneapolis, and a girlfriend of mine was dating a Hollywood stunt coordinator, which he coordinated all of Dar Robinson's movies, which he did a lot of all the stunts for Burt Reynolds. So he
they used to tell me I looked like Burt Reynolds, by the way.
Oh boy. And you're still good looking, sir. And so, so my girlfriend was dating him, and then we were all at a beach bar in Lake Minnetonka. We'd hang out at Lake Minnetonka, and we were playing volleyball, and he was just sitting there, and I was a big jock and a gymnast, of course, and very athletic. And he said, you know, you'd be really good in the entertainment business. And I'm like, yeah, right on. I could be a stunt woman. I'm a badass. And he's like, no, professional wrestling. And I was like, oh, shit, no. Hell no. And
have you watched any wrestling?
Yeah. Well, I heard a few things, and, you know, in the Rumble, I'm from Minnesota. So yeah, with Vern Gagne there and everything. And so, I was like, I never paid no mind, you know? And so he kept bugging me and I thought, God, this, my girlfriend's dating him and what a freaking dude, what a ew. He's trying to beg me or something. I was like totally turned off because I didn't know. He's just very aggressive in a nice way though. And so finally I said, okay, what do you got? And he goes, professional wrestling. And, you know, a friend of mine owes me a favor, which was Ed Sharkey owed him something. Cause who knows what Ed was doing. And so, he introduced me to Ed and he took me on. And of course the old story is, you know, Ed Sharkey did not pay me for like 2-3 years. And I got paid $5. My first
Was you paying him to train you?
No, the thing came from, Kai Michelson is his name from Minneapolis. He was the stunt coordinator. And, I guess he owed Kai some money. And so Kai and I were, you know, he just said, you know what? He owes me money. So I want you to do this because I think you're going to be great at it. So he took, and so anyway, they worked it out and I got to go and train with him for free, apparently. But he kept whatever for about 3 years. And then he decided to pay me $5. $5 after 3 years. And let me tell you, there's a lot of.
Did he charge you trance on the road?
No, I mean, a lot of us roomed together. I remember I slept in a hotel tub while all the guys were out in the other room. Yeah. I mean, it was.
What kind of relationship do you have with Ed Sharkey afterwards? I mean,
oh, great. Are you kidding me? A great relationship.
He didn't pay you for 3 years. He didn't pay you for 3 years.
Yeah. He, even to this day, he'll say, who said I paid her even $5? You know? So I don't know. Yeah. So I haven't seen him in a long time and I would love to see him. Is he, he's still around, right? I don't even
know. Yes, he's still around. I saw him last year up in, 2 years ago up in Iowa.
Okay. In Iowa, is he living in Iowa or Minnesota?
No, he still lives in Minnesota, but we do that big Dan Gable Museum thing down in Waterloo, Iowa. And I wanted him to come down so we could honor Eddie Sharkey in Iowa. So he came down for it.
We wrestled a match one time when Eddie was the referee up in Minnesota. This was when I was with WWE. And I told Eddie, when I get in the ring with the rope and start swinging around, just powder out of the ring. I said, otherwise, you know, I'm going to hit you or something. But he tripped on getting out of the ring. So what he did, I've already gone toward him. I said, sorry, Eddie. He goes, you got to do it, kid. And I just beat him with the rope.
I can just see him. Go, go, do it. It'd be good for the business. Go, do it. Oh, he was a good team player, though.
You got your big break from Wahoo, right? Wahoo called you, wanted to come work with Vern?
That's what it was. He's the one that called and just said, hi, my name is Wahoo McDaniel. And I'm like, oh shit, is this for real? And I remember I was at my grandmother's house and I'm like, yeah, is this for real? He goes, yeah, this is Wahoo. I work with Vern Gagne and want to know if you want to come in for a meeting. And I'm like, oh my God, this is it. So I went in there and I remember walking in the office. His was in this room and it was really long and Vern's desk was way on one side. And there was this long table on the other. And we all sat there and Vern stayed at his table at his desk. And Wahoo and I were sitting at the table talking. And I remember Vern at there, when he spoke and he'd go, he'd always hiss like he did. Yeah. And I don't know. He was just, he spoke and he hissed and he smiled a lot though. And he told me, we have a program. We want you to work Sherry Martel. And I was like, oh my God. Yeah, we're trying to get Sherry in here and have her come in. And of course, Sherry, I don't know, she probably didn't make it or was late. And I think she already knew she was going to WWF at the time. And I think they knew and they wanted someone to come in and do the angle and, you know, take the title. So, but I will tell you, Vern Gagne was so good to us girls. Oh my God, he was so good. I was so green and so awful and so horrible. But he kept putting me on that damn TV and I was scared to death and I couldn't speak. But I was still out there on that camera and he just believed in me. And I remember when I got my first paycheck, guys, it was $800 when I wrestled at the Cow Palace against Sherry. $800 back then. I was like, I was living the dream, you know.
I think this is a cool story. What you did with your first $800?
Yes, my first paycheck. I was so in debt, guys. I mean, there's huge backstories up until this point, and it just, you know, I lost everything or by this time, the first time around. And I was like, oh my God, I couldn't even eat, you know, it was just whatever. So anyway, I would always go to the cemetery and, you know, try to visit my family. And there was three markers there that didn't have markers. And I could never find them, even though I went to the front desk and say, give me the map. And I could never find them. So that first $800 check, I bought headstones for the grave sites, and that's what I do with it. And it's still, of course, they're still there today, to Grandma Magelli and my aunt, which she was a ballet dancer in the Nutcracker. And yeah, it was amazing.
I think if I hadn't been paid for 3 years, I'd have bought a headstone for Ed Sharkey.
That's a good one. You know what? I just still may. Oh my God, that's funny.
And by the way, the name just popped up. Your name when you entered into the Zoom call was Baddest Bitch Ever.
Yeah.
That is your name.
Yeah, Baddest Bitch Ever. Yep, I changed it just for you guys. Yep.
Hey, tell us about the gopher with Vern's Territory, AWA. The gopher who later became somebody very important who might be about to go.
Yes, yeah. Let me see. He's got a big moment coming up. Okay, so there was this guy, I mean, just young, and he had this desk as he walked into the TV area. And he had a picture of himself, I think, and his wife. and he was the gopher. For Vern, he used to run FedExes in the mail and just did all the grunt work and whatever. And I thought, well, God, that's really kind of a good looking guy. And I remember walking over to the desk. I remember to this day, and I looked, I'm like, oh, this guy's got a picture of himself. God, that woman is gorgeous. Oh my God, she's like a model. And it's Eric Bischoff.
Wow.
So Eric was there, and he'd always, you know, run all the little errands, and he had a beautiful picture of his wife. I'll never forget it. And I thought, my God, she's a top model or something, right? And that's how Eric and I met each other, was in AWA. So fast forward, funny you said that. I just wanted to wait till the dust settled, right? Because Eric just got invited to be inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame. And I wanted to wait a little bit, which I usually do with people. I usually wait that 24, 48-hour period, and because you get bombarded, right, with everybody, text calls and whatever. So I just hit him up this morning before the Zoom, and I told him I am so happy for him that he was a big staple in the business and that he changed the world of wrestling, definitely. Big component. And I was so, so happy for him and that I loved him and his family. So,
I don't want to embarrass
congratulations, Eric.
Crystal here, but, you know, I don't know if you knew this, but one time in Oklahoma, Eric Bischoff stretched Jerry Briscoe on Jerry's birthday.
What?
Yeah,
wait a minute.
My 60th birthday, if you can believe I'm that old.
Well, he stretched you. What were you doing?
He threatened me.
I thought you said stretch.
No, he stretched it. They actually got into a shoot wrestling match in their suits in a bar.
And after TV.
Of people. It didn't quite come out the way that I said it. It actually came out the other way. But
Let me set the scene.
What now, happened?
Let me set the scene. Sure, what now, happened? Deborah. I'm 60. I just turned 60 years old. We're in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I grew up right outside of Tulsa, you know, just 50 miles away from Tulsa. I mean, it's my home state.
Right.
And I'm sitting there with three of the biggest wise asses that this business has ever produced. And they're all Texans. Except one from Springfield, Mass, or wherever the hell that is. But it was John Layfield. It was that Brother Love Bruce Prichard. Right there, that tells you there's going to be trouble. Right?
Yeah, with those two together.
And we're celebrating my 60th birthday. Also, in the John Cena. was Eric Bischoff and John Cena. And I mean, John, you know, John's an instigator just like these guys are. And he jumps on when you're down. Like, don't let that baby face fool you, because when you're down and he wants to jump, he jumps with both feet on, just like Layfield and Prichard do. So I don't even know how I come up. You know, I'm in my home state, Oklahoma. Well, you know, Briscoe was a tough guy here in Oklahoma, and you know, he's 60, all that. Bring another round of drinks. So we're drinking everything. Didn't we drink the bar dry that night?
We drank the bar dry.
We totally drank it dry, but it's Oklahoma, so we know they got a back room with a reserve back there in Oklahoma. So we told them it's that back room, and they did. And they brought us more liquor. So there were some guys sitting at the bar, all dressed up, look like they just come out of a back end where you could actually have meetings one-on-one, face-to-face. Looked like they just come out of one of these high-level profiles. And, you know, Vince, TV hotels, we stay at the nice hotel, you know. So It's a nice hotel, and so nice bar. But we're in Oklahoma. So, you know, they're 60 years old, and Layfield and Bruce, all he did is, and all of a sudden, just out of nowhere, little Eric just looked up out of his quarter beer and said, guys, he's 60 years old. He can't be that tough. And holy shit. Pritchard, Layfield, and Cena just started. He just punked you, Briscoe. What are you going to do in your home state? And I'm saying that. I'm not wanting to do that. I'm 60 years old, man, and I'm having a good time. I'm drinking beer with what I thought was friends. And now they're trying to get me into a fight on a barroom floor in Oklahoma. I said, man. So Eric, and they keep on egging Eric. Okay, well, he can't be that. He's 60 years old. And finally, you know, I just had all the harassment you can take. You know, you can take so much harassment if you're competitive, you know. And yes. I just took it. Finally, I said, Eric, what do you want to do then? You know, how you want to find out? So I stood up, you know, like a fool. Eric stands up. Now I'm thinking, holy shit. I'm a mark. I hear all that stuff. What he challenged you? I'm 15-time karate champion. I'm 20-time judo black belt. Man, I'm 60 years old. What am I going to do? You know?
So
while he's talking, you know, I just decide, hell, I'm going to double leg his ass while he's talking, you know, and so he's running his mouth. So I double leg him. We're still in our coat and ties from TV. I don't want to put him down hard on the floor because, you know, he might get a little nasty, might get mad. So I double leg his ass in like 5-10 seconds. I set him up where I got full control with him. And I just set him right back down in his damn bar seat there. You know, nothing, no harm, no foul, nobody's dirty, nobody's sweat, nobody tore the jacket up, nothing. Set back down. And like, well, you didn't take him down, Pritchard. Yeah, Pritchard. And then Eric started, yeah, you didn't take my ass. I just double-legged your ass and set you down because I didn't want to hurt you. Now we're standing back up. And now I'm starting to get that Indian temper starting to get a little mad, you know, okay, you know. And Eric's starting to talk crap to me. So, Cena's as bad as both of those guys put together when he gets rolling. So, and then John Cena's a world. Well, hell, I got to impress the world champion. Why? I'm 60 years old. I don't have to impress nobody. So I start horsing around with Eric a little bit. I grab his head and I kind of feel, you know, I've read about you. You've done the kickboxing. You kind of feel when somebody's a little hesitant, they don't really want to go. You know, just when you lock up with them.
Yeah.
I locked up and I could tell Eric was terrified, you know. So I started.
You would never admit it.
No, I started the head control on him and everything. So I kind of took a couple of steps with him and I knew where I could control his body. So all of a sudden I snapped him down. On the way I snapped him down, I grabbed the front face lock on him and hooked him, overhooked him. He ended up flat on his back, what, John? 30 seconds, 40 seconds, something like that. And I wrap a guy a deal, and John's experienced many times, where I just wrap my arm around and I'll cup your face like that, where you can't breathe. You can't breathe out of your nose. You can't breathe out of your mouth. I'm torquing that neck up. Now I got his neck bent this way, and he can't breathe. And I know that artery there where it pumped that air up to him. It's because I got a good, pretty good grip on that.
Right.
And so Eric starts this.
Oh, tapping
on. And John said, God damn it, Eric, that's not tapping. Tap like you mean it. Now the whole bar is resonating. Tap like you mean it. Tap like it. Pretty soon, Eric's damn ripping my shoulder off because I can feel his body start to lose control because he's losing breath. So I let him go, get up, and I actually helped Eric up and set him back down in his chair, gave him another beer. God damn, he is tough or something. I forgot what to do. But they got me in a fight on my 60th birthday. I could have been rushed to the hospital with coronary disease and all that stuff, but all they did was laugh at me.
No, but you know what? You know what's so amazing about the story? Not only did Eric tap out like a bitch, you remember the best 60th birthday of your life. That is amazing. That is so good. That's a great story. Go ahead.
I couldn't have spent it with better friends. Yeah.
Yeah. And what great antagonists. I mean, between Pritchard and Mr. Producer himself and Cena. I mean, boy, what a motley crew that was.
Hey, and Eric didn't do himself any favors. I love Eric. So does Jerry.
Yes. You know,
they rearranged a lot of furniture in the entire bar in their suits.
I can only imagine. I've seen it. So I know when you guys get down like that and have a good time and wrestlers, everything stops and they watch. And it's great.
Said, look, I'll give it a go. We all went, ooh. That's what he's called. Cheers back.
And I'm not wanting to do anything. I'm just wanting to drink my beer and have a good time.
Let me drink my beer. Why do I got to do this? All right. Don't keep egging me on. But they know that egging on is going to, it's going to come to something. But I got a great segue to that. Here's another Eric story. So when we were in WCW, Eric would always fish like, hey, you know, I'm this black belt. I know karate and I'm going to do this and I can do that. And he goes, why don't we do a segment? Because I was studying, you know, all of this in Japan, right? So it was kind of like, you know, and he wanted to see what I had, I think. And so he had this taped and we were sparring in the ring and I was coming at him in the corner. I don't know, it's out there on YouTube somewhere. And I was coming at him the corner, just kicking the shit. He had his headgear on. He had all his shit on. He was hiding and the feet were coming up. Bam, 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 right in front. And Eric's like this in the corner's like, okay, you know, enough. And then I hit my promo. So yeah, I think he was, reliving or no, this was before your 60th birthday. So maybe, he took it.
That's awful. Take us back now. When you went to Japan, you were the, as John said, you were one of the first ladies to sign a international contract with a Japanese organization. Was it strictly women's organization at that time, or did it have men in it too, or how did all that transpire?
There was no intergenders, no intergender wrestling. It was all Japan women's pro wrestling. It was the first woman to ever sign a deal. It was on a handshake, in fact. And then, the lawyers got involved, which they weren't used to, you know, involving lawyers, but here's a woman that came in that, treated it like a business back in the '80s when she first started, that got laughed at and nose turned up. And when I had business cards made and, booklets put together to market myself. And when I first trademarked my name, Medusa, over almost 40 years ago. So yeah, that was pretty amazing. And being the first woman to do that, it was such a privilege. And I knew that when I went into wrestling, when Kai Michelson approached me, that I did my diligence to find out what I was getting into. And I really looked at the women's wrestling and saw that what was out there. And I said, you know, if I get into this, I really want to change the whole trajectory of women's wrestling and make it very serious. And so I started looking at the Japanese wrestling and the men, and then I found the women. And then I'm like, this is going to be my goal. If I get in, I've got to. And then that's how I thought of my name. I trademarked my name before I even got into wrestling. And I came up with that name just for wrestling before I got into it, with the fact that I knew I was going to Japan when I didn't know when I was going to Japan, because I knew that's when I was going to targeted and hit the next level of wrestling and really be taken seriously. So that I don't, and it did, you know, I'm a visionary, you know, I think of something, I plan it, I vision it and I conquer. And I've been that way my whole life. Now, yeah, there's, you know, roadblocks and stuff in the way, but those walls are put there for a reason.
Where did you live in Japan? Did you live in the dojo? And explain the dojo to people that don't understand if you did.
So the dojo is a place where just the wrestlers and stuff, you train and you eat and live and sleep. And I mean, it is just ridiculous. And the training there, I mean, I didn't know what I was getting into, but I knew what I was getting into just for the little bit of research that I did way back then. It was like VHS days, you know, and it was very hard to come by. You'd have to order and whatever. And so when I did get over there and sign my contract, I knew that before we hit the road, I did have my own apartment. And my apartment, guys, was probably by a 10 by 12. And it was a bedroom, a cooking area, and a bathroom all in one, right? And it was like $2,000 back then. It was very expensive. And but of course, I was on the road almost 300 days a year. So I wasn't at that apartment at all, hardly ever. And the dojo was incredible. The training was incredible. The All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling was very smart. They had their dojo below and they owned a restaurant above. And they had us work in the restaurant while training at the dojo. So when we were waitressing and, you know, serving food and cooking up, when we weren't doing that and then cleaning the kitchen, we were down scrubbing the mat and cleaning that and training 24/7.
Now the language barrier, you're the only American girl there. Do you have somebody you could communicate with and share your problems with? Is it all Japanese? Did you learn the language? And how were you accepted being the only gaijin there?
Gaijin. Yes.
Or whatever the word is for one.
No, it is. You're correct. Gaijin. Correct. And I never knew what henna gaijin meant for the longest time when they were telling me I was a henna gaijin. You know, I was a dork, basically. Henna gaijin, henna gaijin. Oh, funny gaijin, funny gaijin. And I was the only American at first. But then they intermittently brought others in, like Leilani Kai. I did wrestle her. And then I think after I was, women wrestlers starting to come in more. Now, I don't get the credit for this all thoroughly. I mean, fully. I mean, there were women over there before I was. I mean, I believe Sherry was there once, twice, whatever, I think. And Leilani Kai was there quite a few times before I was. But they never signed a contract, and I never got to wrestle with them over there. Now, but there for those, 3 years solid, probably I was the only one. How I got my American fix, I would always go down to the Hard Rock Cafe Tokyo and down at Roppongi and all of that and go see the 80s rock and roll bands and just live my life. And so, yeah, I got to know a lot of great 80s bands back then.
That Hard Rock was a haven for American
dude, there's some great stories out of there. I'll leave that for my book. Yeah, it was amazing. I would never have traded that for anything in my life. It helped hone my craft. It definitely helped me. And
was it fair to say that the women's wrestling then is kind of like the women's wrestling here now? Because you had Jumping Bomb Angels back in the mid-80s. I mean, they drew big, big crowds. It was legit, serious wrestling. And I say that in contrast to what a lot that was going on here, not as a demeaning way to say it. That mm-hmm. That was going on here. It's just kind of, if you were a woman wrestler here, you had to also be a valet. And you didn't have many choices. There you had entire divisions that were drawing big numbers in Japan.
I'm glad you said that. So the JB Angels and the Glamour Girls and Wendy Richter, the rock and roll wrestling era and stuff, they are the ones that really... That was like leveling up. I mean, that was another change, another new era of women's wrestling that clearly does not get enough credit at all. I mean, Wendy was pouring it in. Wendy was huge. Wendy was like a big character. And I'm going to put her as equivalent as Hulk Hogan at that time, and drawn in with Cyndi Lauper and Lou Albano and, you know, the whole thing. And that was short lived. And I don't know why I do with conversations with Wendy, but that's her, you know, that's her deal to tell the story. So I think people, when they want to really look at good tag team wrestling in women's, I mean, I think that's very, that's a good place to start. The storytelling was, is very good. Very good. I love those women. And I got to wrestle the JB Angels too. They were all kind of young. They were in All Japan Women's Wrestling when I was there. So I got to wrestle them a lot. It was an honor. I was like, oh shit.
Now this is the peak time in Japan, or starting with the peak time of the renaissance, so to say, of a ladies Japan wrestling. Was this what you visualized? Was this where you wanted to be, or did you have other lofty goals that you wanted to move out back into the United States and create a scene and kind of revolutionize the style over here? Was that thought in your mind when you're doing, and don't say you're short, you were revolutionizing Japan wrestling and women's wrestling worldwide at this time.
So I knew I had to get back to the States, and that was my home. I wasn't going to stay in Japan forever, even though I wanted to. My heart will always be in Japan. I love Japan. I was just there a few years ago, and I haven't, you know, just haven't missed a beat. And the people are still amazing. But I knew that I needed to get back to the States, because I knew and understood the business that every 2 years is there's a turnover of fans, things change, and you need to keep reinventing yourself. I knew this early on, that reinventing yourself is very important in our business. Keeping who you are in the character and grounding, but you need to keep reinventing your style and whatnot. So I knew I needed to come back to the States. And when I saw what was going on, I'm like, oh crap, man, I need to, you know, I don't know how I'm going to do this, but I just, you know, I need to be silent about it almost. People knew who I was, but didn't know anything about my style. Because if you really, I went from independence to straight to AWA in a short time, then straight to Japan for 3 years. And then, so I knew that I wanted to mix and for the mix American and Japanese together. So coming back over, that's what I was planning on doing, and just take it by storm and introduce a contact, baddest bitch ever type of wrestling. And I wanted to introduce it and let them know I was serious. I was a wrestler, damn it. And that's what I wanted. I didn't want to prance around with, you know, tits and ass all the time, even though beauty is important and your sexuality is what you're comfortable with. And, you know, I don't give a shit what everyone else thinks or says. And that's how I thought. I mean, I always beat to a different drum. I had my own rules, and I tried to respectfully, you know, do other people's rules. But if I felt that it wasn't conducive to what and where I wanted to go, I wasn't going to do it. And I passed good money at times because it wasn't something I believed, you know, that I believed in. A lot of the times through my life, you know, I chose that if it's unethical, immoral, or illegal, I chose not to do it. There are things that I don't know if I regret, but maybe there's things I could have chose differently. Coming back to the States, I was feared. I don't know why.
I don't know why either.
Okay. I work stiff, and I think there's one thing in my mind that I felt. This is what I learned early on, and I felt that if I could do what I did and take what I did, and if you're going to be serious in our business, you better damn well be able to. That's how I felt. And I felt if you're coming in here for any other reason, then you shouldn't be in my business. So be ready to get your ass kicked. You should be able to take a freaking punch. And if you get kicked upside the head with a little bit of a, you know, an
authority.
Egg, Yeah. Okay. We can say we're sorry in the back and then suck it up, Buttercup. Right.
I don't understand that the young people in dojos in Japan were treated like by today's standards, they'd be inhumane. You know, Jerry.
Oh, no, no. It's totally inhumane. I got beat with bamboo sticks. I got knuckles cracked, broke out of position. I've got tendons ripped, tore. I woke up almost 28 hours later because I had both black and blue eyeballs, and they let me sleep for almost a day and a half in the bus, and I finally woke up.
Wow. And the bamboo sticks were not accidents, right? I mean, this was by the instructors.
This is by the instructors when I was learning karate and stuff like that, yeah.
Now, you were learning all this mixed martial arts stuff at the time. And I know during that time, Pride and One and all these other martial arts and combat sports started to evolve, and especially in Japan. I read where you went over to Singapore and you knocked out the damn champion in one punch in one round. Were there promoters coming after you? I mean, did you ever think about it? Maybe I can get into mixed martial arts. Was it a place where women could go at the time in Japan, or was it still a male-dominated, controlled sport there in Japan?
You know, in Japan, I don't know if they were looking at me as because I was American and like, hey, let's just promote the crap out of her. Let's do everything we can. But I didn't feel like there was any of that. Like, you know, they did so much for me. And I think Paul Heyman may have been watching me back then. And that's why he came out with his story in Yahoo.com or whatever. He wrote that wonderful story, you know, she's Ronda Rousey, before Ronda Rousey was Ronda Rousey, she was doing things. And well, so
John and I were talking about in the beginning, you were kind of the forerunner to Ronda Rousey to me. And that's what I was telling John. Did that thought come in your mind that I can go into this other world here and be a world champion and be thought at as different? Or did that thought, or was you a pro wrestler?
So, so I was getting to that where I was wrestling. And the promoters were pretty fair. I mean, it wasn't about man, woman thing. They would just do all this crazy stuff. They'd say, hey, Medusa, you sing. I'm like, I can't sing. We're crap. So all of a sudden I was giving concerts. I had my own CDs. I had this cult following, and the CD was number one hit. And it was like, what the hell's happening? And then they said, okay, you are a good fighter. You're serious. You're a competitor. You need to be a boxer. I'm like, what? And then that's when they started, you know, having me train with the Muay Thai and the kickboxing, the karate. And they said, okay, you're going to Thailand. I said, what? And they're like, yeah, you fight. And I'm like, what? I'm like, I'm here to wrestle. Shit. And then I'm like, okay, I can do that. Okay. I never said no. I was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Then I found out I really liked boxing. And I was like, oh my God, this is awesome. Bam, bam. I was just like, oh my God, this is a whole nother field. And so I actually right now, I can't remember if I had my boxing match first with Aja Kong or if I went over to Thailand and did my Muay Thai kickboxing. I don't know. I can't remember what was first right now, but the blood and the gore and the broken bones and the gimmicks and everything that we did was almost, it was incredible. Now, the boxing was a shoot between Aja and I. The Thailand boxing was a shoot against their champion. They brought me over there like in this. I was scared to death. And she came out with this hairdress thing with this tassel and the Muay Thai shorts. And she did her little dance and came out. And I'm just standing in the corner going, oh, what did I get myself into? Oh, my God. And I was scared to death. And she just like, boom, 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 like almost knocked me out. And I was scared. And I just knocked her out of a punch. And they're like, oh, God, we need to get her out of here. She knocked the champ out and whatever. And so that was one lived. That was a one off. I got out of there. And then they continue to have me box there. And I don't know if I, you know, started it or planned it, but I know it happened. and I know I liked it. And then there was Rumble. Back in the day, there was this guy with the black promoter, the big hair, Don King, right? Is that him? Yes. Don King. Oh my gosh. So there was a boxing woman's champion right around that time. She was the champion. Anybody remember her? So I got word that they were trying to contact me to see if I wanted, and I was going to go and start training in his crib before I got back to the States. And I decided not to, because I thought it's more important to reinvent myself and get myself established as a wrestler to the States first, and then I'll go revisit. Then it never happened. And I think that is one thing I wish I would have done. I think that's the one thing in my life I would have carried through, but who knows where my wrestling career would have been either.
You want to say, but who knows that Ronda Rousey? I mean, it would have been Medusa, you know, everybody talking about.
But it wasn't MMA back then. You know what I mean? There wasn't. And I can't remember saying, God, you know, I see those guys fighting. When did the women get
to do that? They were street fights, literally street fights back in that when they had those things, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yes. Would you like to sing us maybe a few bars about your number one hit song?
Sure. Hold on. Okay, sure. Hold on one second.
Sing a few lyrics.
Mm-hmm. First, here's a first on Briscoe Bradshaw Show.
Mimi Oshumaste Guran Nanikika Eru.
Awesome. I'm in love again.
Absolutely.
It says, let me come and whisper in your ear.
Jerry and I are very happy now.
Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad. Yay. Okay. And then so fast forward through all of that, I just came back and it's like, I felt like everyone feared me and no one wanted to wrestle. And they're like, oh my God, Medusa's, she works snug and she's tight and she's going to hurt. And no, bitch, you just better grab a hold and follow through and listen. And if you don't like a snug hit, then you need to, you know, learn to.
You said something very important right there. When you came back, you had this reputation of, you know, you Muay Thai, you know, judo, black belt, all these martial arts thing that was hot before they became hot, you know, mm-hmm. and to the general public. Now, I know as a guy that has a guy comes in, has a reputation of, you know, being a shooter, being somebody that can handle their
stuff. But I never hurt anybody.
I know. Well, I didn't either. I tried not to anyway.
Well, okay, me too.
So, I will disagree with that.
Except for maybe Layfield a couple of times. I wanted to, but I just couldn't. He has a high pain threshold. So. But anyway, the you just said, the way you were looked at, were you looked at through the female talent in general as this, they were afraid to get in a ring with you? Were they skeptical of it? Where did you go when you came back from Japan? Where was your first stop, and how was your reception? And you know, with that reputation hanging over your head.
Well, I knew I had to come back and reinvent myself, and I wasn't with any top organization, so I knew I needed to work my way in. And so just with those titles and being in Japan, it scared the crap out of everybody. And I had all eyes on me. And so I just work independence, you know, for a little bit. I think that's when I started working independence with John Arezzi, maybe. And we started doing some things across. And I think that's a good story there with Jake when he locked me in the room with his snake and his python or whatever. What? That was in the Philippines.
Yeah. Tell us that story.
Oh, my God.
What kind of snake?
That SOB. It was the white one with the gold.
Defanged?
I don't know, but it didn't bite me. But so I had a closet at least to dress in and or whatever at, you know, in Philippines. And the guys were all out in their room. And I went in. And I closed the door and I barely did like two steps in and the door comes flying open and all of a sudden you see the bag slide and here comes the white frick And I was like, what? I screamed bloody. You could hear Jake and them out there. Oh, my. U.S. Everything I could. S.O.B. And there's nothing but walls. Nothing but walls. And all of a sudden, I see like this thing, this pipe or something. And I'm crawling up a wall on a pipe up into the ceiling. Sure as crap. Here comes this freaking snake on a flat wall. And I'm like just ready to freaking die. And I'm calling him like, you son of a bitch. And you can just hear him. Then, you know, of course he comes in and the snake's coming right at. Oh, I think I pooed myself. I was like, oh my God. Yeah, that was Jake. That was my like introduction to Jake the Snake.
Hey, tell us about the intro to Johnny Valentine. Johnny Valentine was the greatest of all time, but. In fact, I wrestled.
Johnny wasn't really small time.
I wrestled was he? One time down in Waco, and somebody got mad at Jimmy Crockett, and they wouldn't put out posters of the event. So nobody showed up to this match. And in the heart of Texas Arena in Waco, it's me and Greg Valentine on top, except for Johnny Valentine shows up. And all of a sudden, Greg Valentine turns into this hammering tong shooter. I'm like, what happened to you? There's no one here. He went on like half an hour, and he just beat the living hell out of me. His dad's there. Like, look, it's not my dad. I'll put you over. Please stop. But Valentine was his Johnny was a tough, tough old man. Tell us about when you met him at dinner. Because Johnny was also crazy.
So Greg and I go way back. And so Greg and I, we were where did his daddy live then? Where was it?
I don't know. When I wrestled Greg.
Yeah, he lived in Charlotte for a long time. Then he lived in Tampa. Then he lived out in Texas in Fort Worth, I believe.
In the early years, like in the 90s, he lived or anywhere. I think it was Texas or whatever. So we met him for dinner, Johnny, and we were sitting at the restaurant and we're just giggling. And those boys were being boys. And I don't know if his dad was testing me to see like if I was like, if he could do ribs or if I was accepting, if he could accept me or if he could pull one over me. But Greg and him and I were eating at the table.
In a restaurant.
At the restaurant. And Greg was just sitting there and Greg just started giggling. And I'm kind of, you know, just, I'm known with the boys that I don't sell shit. Right. So I'm sitting there and all of a sudden something's going on and fucking Johnny Valentine's pissing under the table in the restaurant while we're eating. I'm like, what the? And I can't remember if I don't think I sold it.
Is this post, this is post accident, right? Post flight.
I'm not sure. Yes. Yeah,
because he's crazy in a wheelchair or crippled or something like that, huh?
No, I don't. Yeah, but he was still. Let me tell you, he's still
Johnny. I mean, no, either way,
that was Johnny. I'm telling you, he did it because they started laughing their ass off, and Greg says, "You're not gonna gonna phase her dad." Oh my! He peed. He just sat and just whipped it out and pissed under the table.
Don't understand that this
was one of those loud long.
So dude, I probably had jeans on, so I probably had it all up my leg. I don't know. Oh my God.
People understand that's crazy stuff like that was not abnormal.
It was a rib. He did it as a rib, not because of whatever. And he was just testing me to see if I was, you know, the up but and
can
up.
Can you imagine someone doing that today? Like some wrestler, you know, somewhere just.
They get hauled off to jail and handcuffs and, you know, half the crit. You know, let me tell you, some of these plane rides is where half the shit went down, too, you know, not just dressing rooms and whatnot. You.
Jerry and I have to do one. That's named just the plane ride from hell. So, yes.
Plane ride from hell. Were you on that one?
Jerry and I both were.
Oh, you absolutely. Too. Oh, my God.
I don't remember it, though.
Yeah, nice. Okay. Yeah, right. Is that what we're doing? We're going to say we don't. That's a nice way to get out of everything nowadays. I don't remember that.
4 o'clock.
I don't recall that, sir.
We went to customs in Hartford, and Jerry and Michael Hayes almost get into a fight in customs. It was pretty insane. The Undertaker had to step in, and among others, and separate the two.
Yeah,
it was quite interesting.
They weren't pushing Michael very hard to separate.
They were trying to egg you too on, I'm sure, as well. Yeah, there's some amazing ribs. There's some amazing ribs back in my time. Some not too good and some just funnier than hell.
Well, can you recall one that you're allowed to tell on a family show that would fit?
No.
I hate those questions because it can put you on such a spot because
No, some... I'm good. Okay. Okay, how about no, not that one either.
No.
No. I'm gonna save them for my book.
All right.
I'm telling you guys, they're amazing. They're amazing. And like John's saying, if any of this crap was done today, everything would be canceled on our ass.
For your book.
Yes.
Like this is the biggest show in the world, me and Briscoe's show.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah.
We'll sell you a million copies just off this one story.
No, alone. I just want to sign. Yeah, okay. No. Well, let's see. This ain't a plain one, but we were talking about Michael Hayes earlier, remember? And I said, I got a Michael Hayes story. So this SOB I was wrestling and it was the whole Paul Heyman thing, whatever. And his big ass was out in the corner, right? He's like, I don't know. He was supposed to take it. Like, he probably felt like he wasn't going to do this for a woman back then. So there was a spot. I was getting up to the top turnbuckle and I was going to come out and do a cross body onto Michael Hayes. That son of a bitch moved and I freaking hit that concrete and busted my foot in half. And I remember it swelled up like a mofo. And right away I knew, I looked right at him and he freaking started running. And I was like, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill you. I ain't touching a woman. I'm like, well, did you want to tell me this when, going over the spot or something? I'm like, I will never forget that. So I remember I just took duct tape and taped my foot and freaking kept. Yeah.
That's how it was back in there, right? You got no medical help backstage. You mm-hmm. just, if you're lucky, somebody had a roll of tape and you just taped yourself up and you went on to the next town. Yeah, I mean, people don't realize how brutal the lifestyle was in the medical care. There were no commissions that you got to have a doctor at every event or, a promoter mm-hmm. say, I got a doctor here for you if you need any help. You were on mm-hmm. your own. I mean, how many times do you roll in so sick from the flu or something like that?
I never missed a spot. I never missed a spot.
I mean, that's so bad.
I never missed a match, never missed anything for 19 years. Never missed a flight.
Wow. Well, I know, sometimes I feel like I'm being stalked on never missing a flight. I always get on these planes, John, and I sit the second or third row all the time. And I notice you get this creepy feeling. Somebody's watching, somebody's looking. And I, for like 6 months in a row, I mean, she wasn't working, she was doing her own thing with the trucks and promotional
monster trucks.
And what a brilliant lady this is. I'd like to really get into all the businesses that you've owned and operated and built up over your years. It's just been phenomenal. You're a fantastic business. But I was being stalked by Medusa. I'd get on this plane and all of a sudden I'd that's Medusa up there. She'd look back and give me a wink or give me a beautiful smile, and I was happy, and the guy next, who's that? But every week,
time
we were on a plane together at least six to eight weeks in a row. And just real random. And I felt like I was being stalked by you.
Whatever. It was funny. Every time we'd be on the same flights. And it would be because monster trucks would be at a facility, and then we would be coming home and you guys would be coming in to wrestle at the same place. So it was pretty exciting. We were always passing each other's on the flights. It was great.
That was my Delta relationship.
It was my Delta relationship with you.
Everybody has an airplane relationship, and that was my relationship. I could have had a better one. But, you know, it's something I find really, really cool, and because he's such an interesting man. Your deal with Paul Heyman, you know, and your ring time with Paul Heyman, that had to be so unique with you, because that's a defenseless man that you were taking advantage of out there.
Paul was so
helpless.
Paul was he was very helpful. And I didn't know why. And I never felt that threat from Paul, which was really nice. And I think that's why Paul and I gravitated towards each other so well. And in business, it was strictly business since day one. And I think he saw a lot in me, and he helped catapult that to the next level in WCW. And he knew I was serious. He knew I was business. He knew I wasn't just a flighty woman. And I wasn't there just for the TNA and a good role in the sack type of thing. And I wasn't there for a casting couch position. So he knew I was serious. And when he did, and he invested in me as far as his time and his knowledge, it helped excel my career. It was him that helped, you know, put me on the map there to do more. The first stint with WCW, as far as my interviews and et cetera. And then aligning myself with the DA, the Dangerous Alliance, which was probably the best faction ever. So I'm just saying. And it was so much fun working with all of those huge, talented men. Bobby Eaton, my gosh, there's a man that doesn't get enough credit at all. Bobby was one of the best wrestlers to watch. He was so fun. His psychology for the business was great for me. I would watch him a lot. And of course, all of them were good. I mean, Arn Anderson, oh my God, what a guy. What a great guy. He was, he couldn't stand that when I would have to do interviews and I'd have to do like 20 takes. And then he would sit there and do his little shit over here and tell me to hurry up and all of that. And I was in the middle of my interview and I took off my high heel and I flung it at him and he ran out of the room. but he was an amazing wrestler. I mean, all of them, it was so great to share the screen and the whole wrestling business with them.
I always thought Rude was one of the greatest heels of all time.
And I don't know. Oh my God. He was, he could egg things on, right? Oh my God.
He was. Rude to me was just everything you want in a heel. It was Rick Rude.
And it was all natural. Like Rick, the thing about Rick was such a natural. I mean, nothing that you saw on TV, I don't think was not Rick Rude. He had that. On the outside, driving a car, he just had that natural attitude, that natural look. He's such a handsome man, and
handsome, cocky, arrogant, but he was funny. He was quiet. So you know who traveled together? It was Rick, Paul, and I. Rick made Paul drive. I had to sit in the passenger seat, and he sat in the back with the windows up, locked, smoking the freaking dope, and I was choking because I didn't get high. And they were laughing their ass off, and I mean, I was screaming, "Crack the freaking windows! Crack the windows!" And he's back there, Deucey. You know, I'm like, dude, I can't do this.
Did he blow it on you?
Did he what?
Blow it on you?
Oh, of course. The whole it was like Cheech and Chong, dude. It was Cheech and Chong in the car.
You said you couldn't get high in that car with Rick.
Contact high.
And the ones that he would twist up. I mean, you're right. It was Cheech and Chong joints. It wasn't those little nickel joints like
going
this.
There were that big.
Yeah, exactly. Like that.
Oh my God! But he really pushed hard for me to stay with him. I didn't like the management position I'm not saying with Rick, I'm just saying, cause I wanted to wrestle. I wasn't the manager girl, but there wasn't much more to do. And there was running out of people and, you know, so, hey, why not? It worked. And it gave me this whole different level that what I could do. And it really expanded my abilities. So I was like, okay, I can do this.
You had the best seat in the house to learn from one of the best right there at ringside with Rick.
And
Rick was one of these talents to me that never wasted a move. No. Everything he did, it's kind of like Jake Roberts. And I think that's the reason Jake blended so well together, because there were no wasted motions in there. There were no wasted spots. Everything fit. And I mean, and most of it was from feel in the ring, which is the amazing part about those.
You know who else it was great to be with was Kurt Hennig.
Kurt's another one that's just a natural like that.
Holy crap. Oh, my
God. So you had some of the best tutelage in the business, and Paul Heyman's mind to go along with it. That had to put a lot in your mind on the focus and the direction of where you're going to go.
It was so much overload, though. You know, it was just so much overload, you know, having so much great talent all in one, trying to get into my brain and realizing what I had. I wish I would have soaked up more. I wish I could have, you know.
Hell, you had it in a car. Most of people nowadays don't have it in a damn locker room with 90 people in there. What you had out of those three people.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'm very grateful. Very lucky to live when I did. I'm very grateful to be in the time that I was. I truly believe that every era has an important era, men or women in this business. And I believe that we not only grow, but the evolution of each decade, I guess, of wrestling, you can say, grows, and you learn and you move on and you move on. I like where we're at today for the women's wrestling. I think there's some phenomenal women. I think that we're almost circling back to where I was. Cause it gets to the point where I get so sick of hearing like, oh, you're so ahead of your time. You were so ahead of your time. And I was, and I am. And, but I take that as a compliment. However, when I got inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2015, John, and I told you this in the interview, that when I seen Vince for the first time, I was like, oh, hell, I don't know how this is going to go. But it was the best introduction. And we hugged and held. And the first thing I said is that, gosh, I'm so sorry. And he said, you know, I knew then where the women were going in that conversation, by what he told me was best compliment ever. Just everything. I always felt that I was a Vince girl, and because I loved the business and I loved the company and I was doing well, and that was the person they could always count on. But I didn't. I disagreed with how they let me go. But
I love the story. How they let you go. But your deal that when they brought you in, you had. You had them of steel when you told Vince, no, you can't have my name. I mean, how many people tell Vince, no, John, and then you get whatever the hell you want?
Well, we're going way back. Yeah, we're going way back before I got into WWF at the time. To Greg Valentine. He's the one that called or reached out to Pat Patterson, said, you really need to take a look. Check this chick out. Right. And so if it wasn't for that introduction, I don't know if I would ever had the opportunity to go visit and talk to Vince and WWF. However, when I spoke to Vince on the phone and everything was good, and we were talking about names, you know, what do you think about a name? And, you know, I'm like, he's like, well, you know, Medusa's good. And I'm like, well, I don't know. I don't think so. I really like that name. I trademarked it. Let's think of another name. And then on the phone, it was like silent. And I was like, you know, oh, shit, I'm fired before I'm even hired. What a dumbass. And then he continued to talk and he was like, okay, we can think of another name. And that's how we came up. Him and I came up with Alundra Blaze. There was another name beforehand. And I'll reveal that in the book. It's pretty amazing. But we went with the Alundra Blaze.
Right. Well, after that, shortly, Vince is going to build what he built now, the women's division.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, so circling back, when we hugged and said I'm sorry and everything, and Vince, I was just like, and I was in rollers. What the hell? You see Vince for the first time in 20, you're like, hi, I'm in rollers and no makeup. Yeah. He goes, oh, you look beautiful. I'm like, gosh, damn. I said, damn, you look good, Vince. That's the first thing that came out of my mouth, because he did. He looked amazing. And he goes, well, thank you. You know, Vince, thanks. And then we start talking, and he said, you know, with the women's division, where we want to go is we want a woman like yourself, the woman that is athletic and strong and independent. And, you know, the woman like when he first hired me, that's the direction that they're going to go. And I was like, oh my gosh, we are what we want. I forgot how he said it. You are what we want in today's woman, something like that. And I just, if you could have seen me gushing inside, it was just like, oh my God, that was like, holy crap, it was amazing. And so I knew exactly where the women were going to go. You know, if they kept at it and kept hard, and I was like, here we are, fast forward, way ahead of my time. Yep. And this is exactly what we were doing, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And I love it. If I was in today's women's wrestling, I would be like,
Who would be your dream match? Who would be your dream match?
I want a retirement match. I mean, everything is always spoke about from the Attitude Era forward, like those women before that never existed. Excuse me. But there's plenty of women even before me that existed. And none of us would be gracing, you know, women's wrestling if it wasn't for that. We get that. However, if I could have a retirement match, I would love a retirement match. But I'm, you know, hey, I'm getting older. I'm not younger. So it needs to happen like now. And I feel like if I still could stretch. In fact, Briscoe, Jared, I think I'm going to come down and take a few lessons from you.
Come on down, sweetheart.
Yeah, baby. And then some good verbiage from you, John. You're good on the mic and you're good with those one-liners. So what a great package. And so I don't know. I you know, everyone says, oh, they want the queen. Well, Charlotte is not the queen. She's not the original queen. If you look at the first WWF, the woman's tops card that they came out with, they called me Queen Alundra. So I feel that the great retirement match is to divine and who is and who was the first queen. I think Charlotte would be a great one to have my retirement match. I mean, everything about it, right? Natalia,
and there's
would be
so
great.
Many you have to pick from now. I mean,
there is, and how do you just pick one?
Now they're phenomenal. I mean, I watch them, and I think it's the greatest growth spurt of in any segment of our business. It is the ladies. I enjoyed watching their matches so much.
Mm-hmm. And they've come a long way. And again, this era, just like any other era, they're going to grow and the next level of women are going to come and whatever happens there. And
you were the spark of that.
I was a part of it. I was a part of it.
I want to ask you about that because you were a spark, especially for the Monday Night Wars, which created the Attitude Era, which got us to where we are now. And I want to ask you if we would get to where we are now without that Attitude Era, because when you went down to WCW, Vince had to cancel the women's division. Didn't have to. He chose to because of money issues in the WWE.
Yes. Let's stop right there, though. He chose to do that. Now, when I got let go by a FedEx letter. I don't know if that was a thing back then, but it was a damn FedEx letter. And I was like, what the hell is this? Like, why? Why is this happening? Right? You know, why? Why did just the women get let go? And that's what fueled me. It pissed me off. I was the face of the company with the women in that company. They could always rely on me on a piss test. I was never late. I always showed up for my matches and I trained hard and I could wrestle like the guys. What was wrong with that? Well, business is business, Miss Michelli. I'm talking to myself here as I'm saying. And I was angry at the situation and how it did it and why they just let the women go. If you have problems, I thought, well, gosh, the guy on Vince's defense in the same freaking breath, he was going through IRS scandals, steroid scandals, and those other things. So there was a lot going on. He almost had to close his door. There was a time when he didn't know if he was going to be happening then. So they needed to probably clean, downsize, get rid, and focus. I understand that. I understand that. I get that. But just to let the women go, guess what? What showed me and proved to me that they weren't thinking right and that they did have a lot on their mind, they let me go when I was still champion. So I knew it wasn't personal.
And you had the opportunity then for the former gopher from AWA, who's now going in the Hall of Fame, Eric Bischoff, who was at the time Vince's biggest.
Don't. I see you're stirring shit already.
No.
You are stirring. No, you're an egger. Yeah. You're an egger.
You're right.
Bischoff beat us.
And to top it off, the people that we've had on have, when they go to return belts, we've had several guys on that's returned the belt and not the exact condition that they were presented about.
That's right. Stan
so that's where he's getting to.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So you go down, you get the opportunity to go to WCW. And I'll let you go back to it. But then, you know, you drop the title in the trash can. But then you have Brett going down to WCW. Because of what you had done, Vince can't allow Brett to take the title. So,
well, I'm really glad that they're up on things and are paying attention to the men and not the women. Oh, okay. Go ahead.
I'm saying it created the Attitude Era. That created Mr. McMahon, the evil owner, and Mike Tyson gets brought in. The whole thing changes. And the women's wrestling kind of devolved into a showcase, for lack of a better term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one of my question is, if you hadn't gone so far away from the physicality of actual wrestling, do you think the pendulum would have swung back as quick to come back to then you had Lita and Trish. Now you have an entire women's division. Tag team champions is equal to the men's. Do you think if you hadn't had the Attitude Era, you would have got to where we are now today because of the way the pendulum moved the other way?
As I said previously, our business changes every it changes like the fans every 2 to 3 years. However, the pinnacle of our business, if you do the history, it has like 8, 7, 10 years, boom, 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 dun, 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 dun. But it has its highs and lows. So the Attitude Era was strong. It was edgy. It was different. It was perfect at that time, whatever happened, right? And then it started diving, right? It needed a change. And so they started changing the trajectory of the women's wrestling and started getting a little serious and invented and did the Divas title. So that was revolutionary. And then they even made it more stronger. So do I think it wouldn't have or would have? I mean, we need change. Change happens for a reason, just like the seasons and stuff. And we need to clean and regroup, and we need mistakes. We need things in our face. We need to falter and go up and down. Failure is just like I said before, and failure is a blueprint, not a destination. And I feel that anything that if we fail, we learn, we succeed, we rise, and we reinvent again. So I think every era has been a very important era. It has taught us things. It has brought us to higher heights, and it's going to continue to do that. I don't think without the Attitude Era, we would be where we're at today, because it is, as with time, the old school days, as we were talking about, could we get by with this today? What would happen today? Could you pee in the restaurant today? No. Would the Attitude Era today be today? Hell, fuck, damn, there'd be so many people. Are you kidding me? Probably not. No. Now we're being introduced to so much more. It's okay to have intergender wrestling and in all walks of life. The acceptance is change. And either you're going to be a horse and buggy and get left behind, or you're going to buy a first class ticket to the first ride to the moon. And I'll never forget when I was sitting in my first financial meeting in the WWF at the time, and they're just trying to introduce how to take care of our money. I never made enough money to even care to how to take care of my money back then, but I listened because I was an entrepreneur and I wanted to hear what they had to say. And I'll never forget, like, Shane, he was so young, had kids running around. And there later on, Shane said, I think it was at Mula's inductions Hall of Fame speech that I did. I don't know where it was, but he said, I am going to someday have WrestleMania on the moon. And I'll never forget that ever, ever, ever. So the next pendulum, I think, men, is maybe your first ride of WrestleMania on the moon.
Jerry, you going to the moon?
I'll be the first. I'll be our first opponent on the moon. I'll be looking at. I'll do the count. I'll look at the North Star. I told you so, Alondra. We made it.
Yeah, to the moon, Alice. To the moon.
To the moon.
Hey, Alondra. Before we let you go, and I want to ask you real quick about the monster truck. In 2005, you defeated Dennis Sanderson, who was your mentor, the Grave Digger, one of the greatest of all time. You become a world champion, first female champion. Which was more fun for you, or is it a way? Is there a way to compare winning the championship in Japan, or winning the world championship with monster trucks? How do you compare the two?
You do and you don't. With wrestling, it's entertainment. And there are huge goals to be set within the entertainment business. But you have to be a bit narcissistic to be in this business a little bit.
Really?
And so I learned that when I was in the hallways walking with Macho Man through the airport. And every time we walked through the airport together and the sun would be shining through the big mirrors and you could see on the other side your silhouettes, he'd stop and go, I'm like, God, these are some narcissistic men. God dang. Anyway, so I feel that with wrestling, it was a competitiveness, but within our own body and around the people, because it's not a competition, it's more of a, self-fulfillment career. And because you actually don't ever win anything. You win what you put out there and the goals that you set. And it's up to your performance and how you do that and choosing the correct avenues, right? But you are never the winner. You are given the greatest opportunity in the lifetime when a promoter chooses you to give you the title, right? He trusts you. He trusts you with that title to represent that company. So that says everything.
And that's what you win there. That's when you win. You won the trust of the promoter.
That's when you win, when you've earned the respect of that. And so I feel that's how I won in wrestling. Now with monster trucks, I'm just an adrenaline freaking monster, competitive, baddest bitch ever. And my God, when I got in this truck, I mean, it gave me more horsepower than my Harley Davidson, right? That I ride every day. And I'm like this, I mean, we're talking like, you know, 1800 horsepower. I mean, who has that? I'm going to get in that bitch and go to my grocery store. Look out. Right. So oh my gosh. When I was introduced to that, I got a phone call and just said, Deuce, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm getting the hell out of wrestling. This shit's changing. I can't stand this crap. It's going somewhere where I ain't. So he goes, well, do you think about driving a monster truck? And this is Mike Weber. He worked in WCW at the time.
I remember Mike. Yeah.
Mike, great guy. And it wasn't for Mike, I would have never been able to drive monster trucks.
Wow.
And yeah, so he left wrestling and went into the monster truck business. And I guess they asked him, look, we need a woman to drive a truck. We never had a woman. We need some asses in the seats. We need somebody who's got crit. He's like, oh, I got the girl for you, right? And so he called me and I said, Michael, what are you talking about, a monster? I've never seen one. I've never driven one. What are you, crazy? He goes, well, I'm like, okay, whatever. All right. You know, me and then I'm sitting there thinking, now what did I get myself into again? Right. So they flew me out and I test drove the truck and and upside down. And Dennis Anderson was there just listening to him, watching his whole body language. And I got in that bitch with no fear. And it was a perfect marriage. I'm not going to say one of my better marriages because I'm in the best marriages I've ever been right now. So back then it was one of my best marriages and it was the best. And so I got out of the truck after digging it out of a freaking pond upside down and I landed and they said, have you ever driven one? And I said, no, sir. And they said, you're hired. And then the next weekend I was entertaining kids and people of alike, 60,000 of them every day of my life for the last 18, 19 years. And I was just in Australia last year driving the trucks as well. And it's been so amazing. And then when I knew my God, when I was in that truck, I knew there was no stopping me and I was serious and I got into it and I drove down the highway into, you know, within the rig, putting up the monster truck, taking them down the wheels, working on the damn thing with my crew chief. And my crew chief and I were in sync. All I would have to do is drive it. And I could feel when I could hear the motor. I never wore earplugs. I just had my helmet on because I'm one of those racers where I need to feel and hear the motor. And I could just hear, I could hear a screw drop out after that loud motor. And I'd go back and say, rear left, lower casing, da, 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 da. And he'd be back there fixing it. We'd be on. Well, that type of understanding led me to win the 2004 freestyle championship ever. And then in 2005, I won the first ever racing championship against my mentor, Dennis Anderson. And it was one of the most amazing times of my life because it was real competition and it was man against woman, Chevy against Ford. And I'm telling you, it was incredible. And a teacher against student. And if that wasn't the most marketing thing that they never did with, well, oh, well, but it was the best. And yeah, that's how that happened.
Awesome.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, hold on.
Well, by the way, is that the Medusa one?
That's my monster truck.
Oh, that's awesome. John and truck. I mean, you could have given him some lessons. John had an old truck and, you know, he went back home to East Texas, West Texas, wherever the hell his home is, Sweetwater, Texas. And he bought this old pickup truck and, you know, the Saddlers, Hermie and Elliot,
yes.
big grassing fan. So he befriended them. And so, hey, I got this truck. Hey, you know, we'll build it. $50,000 later, they build this big engine and stick in this old damn truck. So John back home, you know, here he is, WWE superstar. Now he's got a pickup truck that'll start and make his noise and shake the entire hometown. So he decided he's going to go down to Del Taco and treat his buddies to Del Taco in his truck. So he gets down and I hear all the high school sweethearts that he had, you know, that he accumulated on. They're like, you know, like these small towns, they just line up the thoroughfare. Well, the Del Taco, they had a line of all his old girlfriends there. So he gets there, he places his order. Thank you, Mr. Layfield. He had to crank it up. So he gets up to order window and he had to shut it off. He goes to crank the damn thing back up, and the damn thing won't crank. Now he's got his big Texas ass out. Him and all of his buddies pushing his truck in front of all of his old girlfriend.
You left out a couple of issues here. You're pretty accurate, except for the fact we're in Tyler, Texas. We're wrestling in Tyler, Texas at the old palace. Coliseum, whatever it is right there in Tyler.
Well, I remember that place.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I'm driving my truck to show the boys. I do go through Del Taco. And I do break down and up to Del Taco. But then I have to walk in front of all the wrestling fans because my truck has broke down.
So. Oh, your poor ego.
Oh, my God. It was hot. It was really hot.
Oh, my gosh.
And he told me the story.
Do you have pictures of that truck?
Of course I do. Yeah, it's a 1980 Chevy Stepside, 540 horsepower motor.
Oh my God. Oh my God, that's so cool. So my goal here is after I restore my grandmother's Harley, I have my grandmother's Harley now in the garage.
Your grandmother's Harley, I love that.
What?
Your grandmother's Harley?
Yeah, she's 98. I have it now. She just retired it. Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, I'm going to restore it and stuff. It's an old Harley. And so my goal, you're talking about trucks, is I wanted the old 72, 73 with the slanted nose Ford pickup, the old, but oh my God, that's my dream truck. Yeah, that's my next.
Well, Medusa, thank you very much for joining us. And in all seriousness, are Jerry and I the best host you've ever been with?
Well, Jerry is.
Thank you.
I hate you.
You're both the best. I love both of you. You're amazing. And Jerry, I'll see you back on Delta someday, my dear.
I hope so real soon.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you guys so much. I wish you much success. Yes.